Thank you very much, Glenn. Our next speaker is Rusty Gaffney. I think he's familiar to many of you, but I'd like to read a short bio because I actually learned some things, Rusty, that I didn't know. Rusty is a native Californian who graduated from Stanford University and UCLA Medical School. After serving in the U.S. Air Force, he practiced ophthalmology for 30 years and retired in 2001. And at the time of his retirement, he decided to devote his energies to writing The Penophile, which many of you may subscribe to. I know I do. It's an online newsletter that was the first wine publication exclusively devoted to Pinot Noir. As a physician, he has a special interest in the health benefits of wine and has written extensively about this subject in his newsletter. He is a member of the Renault Society. Is it pronounced Renault? The Renault Society, which is a group of physicians dedicated to supporting research and education about the health benefits of wine. So let's give a warm welcome to Rusty.
Okay. Well, thank you for inviting me here. This is a subject that I've been interested in for a number of years. And the theme, the message I want to get across today is not too much, not too little when we talk about wine and its health benefits. We know that wine in moderation provides a number of proven health benefits. Too much wine, heavy drinking, no wine, abstaining, provide no health benefits. I think, I feel like I'm kind of preaching to the choir when I'm talking to this group about the health benefits of wine. All of you enjoy wine for a number of reasons. It's relaxing, it tastes good, it's a social beverage. It inspires us, it gives us memories. There are a lot of benefits. So why are we so concerned about possible health benefits, other benefits to be gained from wine? Well, first of all, we're a nation that's has a Puritan heritage, and we've always had a conflicted attitude about wine. We're infatuated with finding a justification for drinking wine. We're also a nation that's in love with quick fix diets. And we like the idea of being able to lie on the couch with a glass of red wine in hand and stay fit and thin. We also are a culture that fears growing old and the possibility that a glass of red wine could be a fountain of youth is very tantalizing indeed. Probably the biggest impetus to look into the health benefits of wine, it comes down to the heart. Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death in this country. It accounts for over half of the deaths in women and nearly half of the deaths in men. And 35 years of sound medical research, scientific research, has supported the notion that wine in moderation is good for heart health. It's been shown that if you take a group of people who do not drink wine and who begin drinking wine in moderation, meaning 1 to 2 drinks per day, only stopping smoking would have more of a health benefit than the institution of moderate wine consumption. Actually, the solution to a long and healthy life has been with us since before antiquity. The orangutans in Southeast Asia have been observed to perform a ceremony called the durian ceremony. Durian is a tropical fruit, and what they do is they put it into holes in the ground, allow it to ferment. It reaches about 5% alcohol, and then they feast on the pulp of the fruit and become intoxicated. So this proves that alcohol consumption is primordial, that people, that monkeys have enjoyed it way before man, and that drinking for effect predated civilization. We know that health and wine have been inescapably linked since ancient times. Man has been consuming wine for over 10,000 years and using it as a medicine for over 5,000 years. The use of wine as a medicine has been well described in both the New and Old Testament of the Bible. The Greeks were crazy about wine, and Hippocrates, the father of Western medicine, advocated the use of wine in practically every illness that he had identified. Pliny the Elder described wine as a medicine. It's interesting that in the total absence of any scientific research, the Greeks understood that it was wine in moderation that was helpful. And wine taken in excess was toxic and could be harmful to our health. It's interesting also that the first book ever published on wine was written by a physician and surgeon. The first report of the effects of moderate alcohol consumption and the relationship between alcohol intake and mortality dates to 1926. This is when Raymond Pearl, a biologist, a wine lover, and a pioneering researcher into aging, published his book called Alcohol and Longevity. What he did is he studied chickens, and he found that chickens who were fed a diet containing alcohol lived much longer than chickens that were fed a normal diet without alcohol. And then what he did is he did an extensive scientific study, a statistical study, of a group of people in Baltimore, Maryland. And he came to the conclusion that moderate drinkers exhibited lower rates of mortality, and heavy drinkers exhibited considerable increased rates of mortality. Pearl's carefully collected scientific data was presented as life tables in his book. But the information clearly validates the now well-known J-shaped curve relationship between daily alcohol intake and total mortality. Pearl himself never published or described the J-shaped curve, but what I've done here is I've transferred to this graph the age-specific death rate tables, for example, 62-year-old male and females. And you can see the drop in mortality with moderate consumption of alcohol, and then a rapid rise with heavy consumption of alcohol. During the 1970s, Dr. Klatsky, a cardiologist working here in Oakland, California, did a number of studies and confirmed the J-shaped curve. He found the lowest risk of death was among drinkers who took less than 3 drinks per day. And he also showed that light to moderate drinking protected against coronary artery disease. The J-shaped curve has been validated by extensive epidemiological studies. It holds true for cardiovascular disease, stroke, longevity, some cancers, and dementia. So today, the J-shaped curve is accepted almost as a rule of nature whenever health and alcohol consumption is debated. We should mention the definition of a standard drink because this will come up in my talk here several times. Actually, a standard drink hasn't been specifically defined in this country, but it's generally accepted to be 5 ounces of 12% wine. And this translates, a typical bottle of wine contains 5 to 7 drinks depending on the alcohol percentage. Moderate drinking is generally defined as less than 3 drinks per day. Heavy drinking is 3 or more per day. Binge drinking is more than 4 on a single occasion for men, more than 3 for women within about 2 hours. The dietary guidelines for Americans are a little more conservative, and they are 1 drink per day for women and no more than 2 drinks per day for men. So just keep those definitions in mind as we go along further and talk about some scientific studies. In 1973, there was an alarming report that came to light in this country, and it was called the fetal alcohol syndrome. And researchers at University of Washington reported infants born to mothers who drank heavily during pregnancy, and these infants had a number of growth deficiency, behavioral problems, learning disorder, abnormal facial features. And alcohol was labeled a teratogen, and the public was quite alarmed about this, but as it turned out, further studies found that this condition only affected mothers who drank heavily, and we're talking 8 to 10 drinks per day. Despite this, the Surgeon General in 1981 issued a warning that mothers who drank during pregnancy risk giving birth to undersized children, and this echoed a similar warning he had issued to cigarette smokers a number of years earlier. This is some typical infants born with fetal alcohol syndrome. You could see the flat nasal bridge, the thin upper lip, and the smooth philtrum. These are typical facial features of these children. So the forces of temperance were on the rise, and the alcohol industry was under siege by the U.S. government in the 1970s and 1980s. In 1974, the Framingham Heart Study, which had begun in 1948, was published. The National Institutes of Health prevented the publication of the part of the study that found that there was a striking reduction in coronary artery disease from moderate drinking in men and women. They were concerned about this leading to alcohol abuse. In 1986, as the study progressed, it showed and confirmed the classic J-shaped curve for men and women, and it found that light drinkers were 70% less likely to have heart attacks than abstainers. The study also showed that moderate consumption of alcohol, rather than abstaining, had a greater effect on heart health than even reductions in blood pressure and cholesterol. A few years later, in 1982, the FDA suggested that alcoholic beverages should contain warning labels. And in 1988, Senator Strom Thurmond introduced a bill to the Senate, which in final form was signed in 1989. Actually, Strom Thurmond had campaigned for a warning label since 1967. And this is the government warning that you're all familiar with on wine. The interesting thing is that this warning basically had no effect on drinking in the United States. If you look at the adult per capita table wine consumption from 1970 to present, compare that with the adult population, you can see a steady rise in consumption with a little dip during the 80s. In 1991, there was a very significant event that happened in this country, and it was a television feature on 60 Minutes in which Morley Safer talked about a health conundrum known as the French Paradox. And in this program, he featured two medical experts, Curtis Ellison, a professor at Boston University, and Serge Renal, a cardiologist and researcher in France.
The French diet, the paradox, has begun to intrigue foreign researchers, among them Dr. Kurt Ellison, a cardiologist and professor at the School of Public Health at Boston University. Dr. Ellison is launching a major study in four countries, comparing three nations' diets over a one-year period with the French. He is in Lyon to consult with French scientists and to have the odd good meal.
I was just looking in this restaurant where I was having lunch. This is something you just wouldn't find in an American restaurant. A Lyonnaise salad bowl, which is pig's head pate with parsley, black pudding, which, you know, is very fat, and potatoes in oil. Double fat sliced tripe sauteed with onions, and hot sausage with lentils and potatoes in oil. This is routine stuff.
The farmers have been eating this for years. They've been eating a very high fat diet, it seems, and yet they don't get heart disease. If we took the same diet, put it into an American, you know, we would all be suffering from coronaries at an early age. There's something about the French, it seems to be protecting them. And we're not sure what it is we're looking for.
Most American nutritionists agree that dairy fat, including cheese, is a major enemy to a healthy heart. And here is the paradox again. In France, there are cheese shops everywhere and hundreds of varieties and textures, from triple creme to soft brie and camembert. Each French man, woman, and child consumes a full 40 pounds of cheese each year. Does cheese deserve its bad reputation? Dr. Renaud says no, it is milk we must be careful of.
Surveys in different countries show a very, very strong relationship between the intake of milk and the mortality from coronary heart disease. While for cheese, there is no relationship at all.
Dr. Renaud believes it is the difference in the nature of calcium in milk and cheese. In cheese, perhaps because of fermentation, the calcium neutralizes the fat, combines with it, and it is then excreted by the body rather than absorbed. Whole milk, he says, promotes heart disease because the calcium will not combine with the fat, which is absorbed into the bloodstream.
If you go to the north in France, there is not that much olive oil. They're using more butter and olive oil.
Of course.
And yet the rates are still lower there. Now, why are the rates in Lille lower than in Boston?
Well, my explanation is, of course, the consumption of alcohol.
There has been for years the belief by doctors in many countries that alcohol, in particular red wine, reduces the risk of heart disease. Now it's been all but confirmed. The wine apparently affects the platelets, the smallest of the blood cells. It is platelets that cause blood to clot. They prevent bleeding. But they also cling to rough, fatty deposits on the artery walls, clogging and finally blocking the artery and causing a heart attack. The wine has a flushing effect. It removes platelets from the artery wall. So the answer to the riddle, the explanation of the paradox, may lie in this inviting glass.
So this program was watched by almost 34 million Americans. Within a month of the broadcast, the red wine sales increased 44%. The idea that actually drinking wine might be good for you was kind of a novel idea in 1991. This is despite the fact that there were a number of research studies dating back to Raymond Pearl during Prohibition that indicated that drinking wine might be good for you. This same year, Sir Richard Dahl, who was the world's leading epidemiologist, came out and confirmed the fact that moderate consumption of alcohol reduced the risk of coronary artery disease. Still, despite this program and despite the emerging research, the government was dragging its heels. The BATF prevented any wine producers from quoting the 60 Minutes program. Robert Mondavi had printed up some neck hangers for his wines with quotations from the program, and he was ordered to desist. In 1991, the American Dietary Guidelines for Americans basically advised Americans not to drink at all, claiming that it was linked with health problems and had no net health benefit. The Wine Institute here in California also strongly advised against any publicity proclaiming wine a healthy drink. To this day, the federal government does not support any alcohol research that has to do with the health benefits of wine. In 1995, there was a significant study in Copenhagen, Denmark, in which they compared the effects of wine, beer, and spirits. And it was found in the Copenhagen Heart Study that wine was more protective against coronary disease than either beer or spirits. 60 Minutes aired another program on the Copenhagen study called To Your Health. Morley Safer traveled to Copenhagen and interviewed the author of the study. And again, this had a tremendous impact on people in this country. Over 20 million people saw this broadcast, and red wine sales shot up 26% in the following weeks.
This is Copenhagen, Denmark, 1995, where perhaps the most significant study to date on the relationship between health and alcohol has been conducted. It's now been completed. It was called the Copenhagen City Heart Study. You may find the results surprising, even shocking.
With regard to wine drinking only, teetotalers had double the risk of dying as compared to those who drank wine daily. So there was quite a large difference, and this was very highly significant.
Dr. Morten Grønbæk conducted a 10-year study of more than 13,000 people between the ages of 30 and 79. The study was sponsored by the Ministry of Health, one of the most carefully monitored such studies to date. It included a breakdown of the kinds of alcohol people drink.
Once you did this study, what was the thing that surprised you most?
What surprised us most was the finding that wine intake, even at a moderate intake, up to 3 to 5 glasses of wine, implied significantly very much lower mortality with regard to all causes.
A similar amount of beer, 3 to 5 glasses a day, did not affect mortality one way or another. As for spirits, hard liquor, Grønbæk's study showed that only a small amount, perhaps 1 drink a month, was beneficial. 2 or 3 drinks a week did not affect things one way or another, and as much as 3 to 5 drinks a day increased mortality, increased the death rate.
So finally, by 2005, the United States government conceded, and the current United States dietary guidelines do say that alcohol has beneficial effects when consumed in moderation in middle-aged and older adults. They define moderation as 1 drink a day for women and 2 drinks a day for men. They stopped short of recommending alcohol consumption in younger adults. This is not surprising because in the United States alone, 30,000 college students are hospitalized with toxic alcohol problems every year. So alcohol abuse is a significant problem in the younger population. On the other hand, teaching younger people, the millennials who have a particular interest in wine at the present time, to incorporate wine into their lifestyle and drink wine regularly with meals has possibly a significant health benefit over their lifetime. The dietary guidelines also did not recommend that anybody start drinking that hadn't been drinking. This is in contrast to our British surgeons, physicians and surgeons, who advise their subjects to get wet for the good of their hearts. It's interesting that now our government is conceding the fact that alcohol, wine can be beneficial, and the French are starting to take, their government is starting to take an anti-wine stance. And the French now have banned advertising on the internet and television. In February of this year, the French government sent out a document to all the physicians in France, which stated that the risk of cancer was significant depending on the amount of alcohol consumed, and also stated that wine had no health benefits against cancer. Naturally, this has sparked quite a bit of growing criticism in France. Well, what is it about wine that's healthy? Why is wine healthy? Well, there's two parts. Alcohol has some health benefits, and the polyphenols. And undoubtedly, it's the polyphenols in wine that give it the superior health benefits. Polyphenols are phytochemicals. They're compounds that are found in many, many fruits and vegetables and have biological activity in the human body. During fermentation of wine, the polyphenols are extracted into wine in a form that the body can use. It's a stable form And this is why wine is superior to grape juice, grapes, raisins, and so forth as a source for polyphenols. The flavonoids are the most carefully studied group of polyphenols. They're very abundant in wine. They're over 100 different in wine. Wine has more polyphenols than any other fluid. And because of the, as I said, the alcohol in wine, they're in a stable form which can be utilized in the human body. Red wine has about 5 times the polyphenol content of white wine because the polyphenols, of course, are in the skin and seeds of grapes. There are three classes of flavonoids. The ones that are the most known and have been most researched are resveratrol, one of the anthocyanins, and the flavanols, catechin, quercetin, procyanidines, and condensed tannins. The levels of polyphenols vary among different grape varieties and vineyard locations. The highest levels of resveratrol are in wines from cooler climates. As you can see from this graph, the highest levels are in Burgundy wines from Burgundy and Oregon. Pinot Noir produces wine with the highest resveratrol count, regardless of where it is grown. And wines made in traditional methods in small wineries, presumably frequently because they're unfined, unfiltered, have the highest flavonoid content. We don't really know all the reasons and all the that polyphenols are so beneficial to our health. We do know a couple things. First of all, polyphenols are very powerful antioxidants, even more powerful than vitamin E and some of the other antioxidants we get in our diet. In the body's biochemical pathway, we produce free radicals. These are waste products, and they're the body's terrorists. They travel around and try to attach their unpaired electron. This process is called oxidation. The polyphenols, you can see the structure here of resveratrol, have a catechol group on the aromatic ring. That's represented by the red balls. And this attracts oxygen-free radicals. The result is that the polyphenols are able to attack and destroy free radicals. And it's the polyphenols in wine, not alcohol, that perform this function. These free radicals interact with important cell components. It's thought that this process of oxidation produces the diseases of aging. The most diabolical effect of the free radicals is atherosclerosis, or hardening of the arteries. And it's been shown that that bad cholesterol, so-called LDL, in itself is not particularly harmful, but once it becomes oxidized, it's attacked by free radicals, it then becomes deposited in artery walls and forms plaques and causes narrowing of the arteries. The polyphenols are also anti-inflammatory. They are able to influence cells and tell them to produce particular proteins that can fight off illness. They can, they've been shown to reduce inflammation in cells, and they can also influence cell division, which may have some potential value long-term in treating tumor growth cancers. Resveratrol is the polyphenol most likely to succeed. It's the one that's received the most attention. You probably saw this cover of Wine Spectator here recently. Most of the research is focused on resveratrol. And this is a polyphenol that actually has been around and known about for a long time, in that the Asians used it as a herbal remedy for centuries. It was finally isolated from the Japanese knotweed. Cornell scientist Leroy Creasy first isolated it from red wines in 1991. Most of the research on resveratrol has been centered on mice and in vitro studies. It's been demonstrated to have many beneficial effects on the human body and also on laboratory animals. And interestingly enough, resveratrol is able to activate a gene called the SIRT1 gene in humans, which appears to control aging. It also can activate the sirtuin genes in lower organisms such as yeast, worms, and fruit flies, and has been shown in the lab to extend the life of these organisms. In 2004, Harvard researcher David Sinclair, and along with another researcher, Christoph Westphal, launched Sirtris Pharmaceuticals. This was a company designed to develop drugs based on polyphenols, such as resveratrol, that could treat specific diseases of aging that are influenced by the SIRT1 gene. There's still a lot of things to be learned about age-related diseases and how the SIRT1 genes affect these diseases, but this is pretty exciting research. In 2006, Sinclair reported this study, which probably a lot of you read about in the newspapers. It was highly publicized. He took a group of genetically induced obese mice and supplemented their diet with resveratrol and found that they, even though they were fat, obese, they lived much more fulfilling lives than obese mice not given resveratrol. This was been called the holy grail of aging research, but of course one caveat was that a 150-pound man would have to drink 1,500 bottles of Pinot Noir a day, just gave the same dose that Sinclair gave his mice. Nevertheless, it's pretty exciting stuff. The press picked up on this, and here's a cute cartoon that came out about this. Can you read it in the back? No, okay, well, honey, would you be healthier if you lost some weight? No, listen, there's good news. Scientists gave obese mice a compound found in red wine, and the mice stayed healthy. And she says, well, the study said that to get the same dose that they gave the mice, a person would have to drink between 750 and 1,500 bottles of red wine a day. And he says, the news just keeps getting better and better. So this was the third...
17 years ago, 60 Minutes first examined the so-called French paradox, which suggested that the French, despite a high-fat diet and high consumption of wine, had a remarkably low incidence of heart disease compared with Americans. Most researchers agreed that there was something in the wine that offered protection. And a few years later, even the highly cautious federal dietary guidelines say that moderate consumption of red wine can be beneficial. Now, scientists across the country have identified a substance in red wine called resveratrol that they believe might do more than just protect the heart, but could, in very high concentrations, significantly extend life by preventing a number of age-related illnesses. If they're right, we all may soon be taking a pill that could give us an extra decade or two of healthy old age.
If the promise holds true, I think this has the chance to change healthcare.
Dr. Christoph Westphal says we all may soon be taking a drug that just might beat the clock, a simple pill that could delay the inevitable.
Our goal is to prevent and forestall many of the diseases that strike us as we reach 50, 60, and 70, all with one pill.
What you're suggesting is that it's some kind of rejuvenation drug that turns a 70-year-old into a 35-year-old.
That might be pretty hard to do, but I think if we're on a train heading one direction, we can slow down that train. I think we can slow down these genes that control the aging process.
That quest to put death on hold began in 2003 when Westphal met David Sinclair, a biochemist at Harvard, who was studying the genetic components of aging.
5 years ago, I met David, and he had shown that you could extend lifespan in yeast. That's pretty exciting.
Now, if you happen to be a yeast, it's very exciting. Yeasts are one thing, human beings are more complicated. So So Sinclair focused on a gene present in almost all life forms, the sirtuin gene. It's normally inactive, but when it is active, Sinclair believes it triggers a survival mechanism that extends life. Convinced that something in nature could activate that gene, Sinclair randomly tested thousands of compounds. And bingo, he got a hit. Resveratrol.
When I Googled this resveratrol, I was shocked to find that red wine was the top hit.
Red wine is brimming with resveratrol. It's found in high concentration in the skin of the grape and seems to play a role in protecting it from invading bacteria and fungi.
Were you aware of the research into red wine that it offered certain health benefits?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's why I almost fell off my chair when the link was made, and I thought that this was a potential explanation for the benefits of red wine.
Convinced they were on the verge of a major scientific breakthrough, Sinclair and Westfall launched Sirtris, a Cambridge, Massachusetts research company. They, along with a handful of other cutting-edge biotech companies, are developing resveratrol-based drugs that they believe zero in on the longevity gene.
The sad news is that you'd need to drink about 1,000 bottles a day of red wine, which I don't recommend.
The pill itself may not extend lifespan, but could prevent the diseases of aging, Alzheimer's, diabetes, heart disease, even cancer.
What we're talking about is activating the body's natural genetic defenses against diseases, and that's very powerful if we can harness that. Talking about is potentially making a 90-year-old as healthy as a 60-year-old. A 90-year-old can play tennis and see their great-grandkids graduate from college. People will live active, healthy lives and then die quietly in their sleep. And that's really the aim here with these medicines.
Are we on the edge of maintaining active lives into our hundreds, for example?
Well, we've certainly passed a corner in terms of the science, and someone's going to achieve it. And if it's not us, it's going to be someone else.
So the question that most of us want answered is, when do we get this pill?
I would say 5 years, to be conservative, that this will happen within our lifetimes. I'm fairly certain about that.
One measure of the potential of this research, Dr. Sinclair and Dr. Westfall's little startup company was recently bought by the pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline for almost $750 million.
Well, not everybody agrees that resveratrol is polyphenol most likely to succeed. Roger Corder has actually written a book about other polyphenols that he believes have more influence on heart and artery health. But most researchers now feel that it's the combination of polyphenols in wine, the synergy between multi-polyphenols that give the health benefits. That's why the resveratrol supplements that are on the market are really, it's not clear that those really have any benefit. Why would you want to take a supplement when the cocktail, the mixture of polyphenols is perfect in wine? Just briefly here to summarize, what do we know at this point about the health benefits of wine specifically with regard to diseases? With heart disease, we know that alcohol and red wine reduce the risk of hardening of the arteries and heart attacks by up to 60%. If you also avoid smoking, you stay lean, you exercise regularly, and you follow a diet low in animal fat and high fiber, you can actually reduce your risk of coronary artery disease to 70%. How does wine do this? Well, it's thought there are six major ways. It raises good cholesterol. It lowers bad cholesterol. It prevents bad cholesterol from being incorporated into the walls of arteries and causing plaques. It acts as an anticoagulant by decreasing platelet stickiness. It causes less stress, relaxation, and boosts the production of omega-3 fatty acids. If you look at the relationship between good cholesterol and good cholesterol, by the way, takes cholesterol to the liver where it's metabolized and removed from the body. Good cholesterol, you can see significant rise in levels with increasing amounts of alcohol consumption. Alcohol, that is wine, moderate wine consumption reduces the risk of stroke of all kinds in men and women, and consumption of 1 to 2 drinks a day reduces the risk of peripheral artery disease in men. As far as cancers go, we know that alcohol is a carcinogen, but we also know that the polyphenols in wine have the ability to oppose the oxidative effects of alcohol that cause cancer, and polyphenols have been shown in vitro to reduce cancerous tumors. Clinical studies have shown that wine appears to protect against the precursor of esophageal cancer. Men who drink red wine have a lower risk of prostate and lung cancer, and wine drinkers have a lower risk of stomach and colon cancer. As far as breast cancer, we'll address that in a minute. Dementia, moderate wine consumption appears to delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and other forms of dementia. It appears to improve the cognitive function of the elderly. We've already spoken about its effects on aging, there's a lower overall mortality with wine drinking. Will Rogers said wine had such ill effects on Noah's health that it was all he could do to live 950 years, just 19 years short of Methuselah. Show me a total abstainer that ever lived that long. And wine does a lot more. Wine drinkers have less colds. They have less type 2 diabetes mellitus. They have lower rates of obesity and decreased weight gain overall. They have decreased forms of liver disease, hepatitis, and gallstones. Less peptic ulcers. About half the risk of developing cataracts and less likely to develop age-related macular degeneration. Men with high blood pressure have been shown to have a 30% lowered risk of heart attack when they drink 1 to 2 glasses of wine per day. Moderate wine consumption reduces stress and the incidence of depression. It appears to retard aging changes in the skin. It lowers the risk of rheumatoid arthritis by up to 50% compared to abstainers. It's linked to increased bone density in elderly women, possibly lowering the onset of osteoporosis. 2 glasses of red wine, just recently this Spanish study came out, shows increases female sex drive, and men who are moderate consumers of alcohol have less erectile dysfunction compared to non-drinkers. There are a couple special concerns for women. Physiologically, women are not as good at drinkers as men. There are several reasons for that. They tend to be way less, have less body fat. I mean, have more body fat, excuse me. But mainly, they have half as much alcohol dehydrogenase per unit of body mass in the stomach. This is an enzyme that's critical for processing alcohol. However, any health risks in women associated with moderate drinking are extremely low. That said, there are 2 conundrums for women, and those are drinking during pregnancy and breast cancer. Public health officials and physicians in this country recommend that women not drink during pregnancy. There are a number of countries that feel that a small amount of drinking during pregnancy is not a problem, and studies have shown that women can safely drink a glass or two of wine during pregnancy, and in fact their children often turn out a little better. It's generally recommended that women who decide to have wine during pregnancy consume minimal amounts, sip it slowly with food, and to avoid rapid rise in alcohol levels. With regard to breast cancer, this is an area in which the last word hasn't been written. Some studies have shown an increased risk in women. Other studies have shown no risk. it's generally felt that there is a 6 to 10% increase in risk for each drink a day a woman consumes. But when you look at the fact that 12.7%, this is what the statistics show, women will be diagnosed with breast cancer sometime in their life. If you assume a 6 to 10% increased risk, the risk is really only increased a small amount. And this risk is really trivial when you consider that heart disease causes 10 times as many deaths in women as breast cancer, and heart disease deaths exceed breast cancer deaths in every decade of a woman's life. Plus, a diagnosis of breast cancer carries a cure rate of over 90%. So it's been shown that small amounts of alcohol lower the risk of the more common causes of death in women, such as heart disease, dementia, hip fracture, stroke, and so forth. Curtis Ellison, who you saw in the 60-minute program earlier in 1991, is considered the authority on this in the United States, and he has stated that for women who do not binge drink, and by the way, binge drinking in women definitely increases the risk of breast cancer dramatically. Women who do not binge drink, have adequate intake of folate, and are not on hormone replacement therapy, the risk of breast cancer appears to increase, and that increase, as I said, is only 6-10% for consumers of more than 1.5 drinks per day. So here's to good health. See your doctor, have your cholesterol and blood pressure checked, don't smoke, exercise regularly, stay lean, follow the Mediterranean diet, don't snack, consume smaller portions, and especially consume a moderate amount of alcohol, especially red wine, regularly with meals. Avoid binge drinking, which offers absolutely no health benefits and is actually dangerous. So here's my prescription, 5 to 10 ounces of wine, enjoy most days, consume with food, consult your physician if you have any concerns that there are reasons why you should not be drinking. The one thing you'll run into with physicians is that they're poorly educated about the health benefits of wine, and they're often reluctant to advise you to drink wine regularly because of concerns of alcohol abuse and so forth. And hopefully your doctor won't tell you what this doctor did. I'm taking you off wine, women, and song and putting you on whole grains. So in summary, most agree that until we have a well-executed, randomized, double-blind intervention trial controlled for all confounding variables, the debate as to the health benefits of wine and beverage alcohol as part of a healthy lifestyle will continue. The argument rages on, but I'm with the majority of physicians who are confident that wine is good for you. And I leave you with this quote from Herman Smith Johansson, a cross-country skier from Sweden who died at the age of 103. And his statement was, "The secret to a long life is to stay busy, get plenty of exercise, and don't drink too much. Then again, don't drink too little." Thank you.